far from the game that you're in the mold, across in the Argonne, will tell you the story, for each one may read on its rain-battered mold. A final box score that is written in glory, the final box score of a player who gave the flag that he fought for, his ghost and his grave. Green be his couch, where the white lilies lean, crimson the poppies that keep guard above him. Gentle the darkness that gathers between the player at rest and the torn hearts that love him. God give him refuge where life's flag is furled, a dreamer gone back to the dust of the world. Low be the lost winds of France that must creep over his rest in the lost tavern lying. God, send thy dreams where the darkness is deep. Father, they care where the wild storms are flying. No monarch there, but for the soul of a man. We speak for a brother, one of the clan.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to This Week in 1920s Baseball. This is your co-host, Josh, a.k.a. Buckfoot. I got my man, Matthew, a.k.a. Sweetbread, here with me. How you doing, Sweetbread?
What's going on, Buckfoot? I'm doing well.
Doing well. That was a intense opening read here. I mean, there's Grantland.
Yeah, chills. Yeah, it gave me chills as I was reading it.
It really is a chills giver. Grantland Rice was an amazing prose stylist, and also obviously, you know, at the time, a sports writer could just write a beautiful poem and include it on the front page, and that was part of the world that sports coverage. And of course, what he's referring to is the death of Eddie Grant, who was one of about half a dozen of ball players who died in World War One. Or of course, they didn't call it World War One at the time. That would have been ominous if they called it World War One.
They right? would, yeah, like they would have known something. Like there was, yeah, something was, yeah.
What'd they call it?
I think they called it the Great War, maybe even just the war. Yeah.
Makes sense. So Eddie Grant died in France in the war, and the Giants, who he played for, placed a memorial in the polo grounds. And on Memorial Day, which also you said it wasn't called Memorial Day at the time.
Yeah, it wasn't officially called Memorial Day until 1967, I think. But it was also called Decoration Day. I think Memorial Day had already started to become used in some ways by this time. But I think the more of the official name for it at the time was Decoration Day.
I wonder if it's just the change in the sort of usage of the word decoration that prompted it.
Yeah.
But obviously it was, you know, so fresh. I mean, he had just died a couple of years prior, and the Memorial Day, Decoration Day, or, you know, the memorializing of the war dead was no, you know, abstract. It also isn't now, but it was so much more immediate for the fact that for the players. I mean, we're talking about guys were taken out of their uniform and put in a different uniform and fought and died overseas. So, you know, Grantland Rice wrote this moving piece to honor Eddie Grant. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but we also want to just set the stage of the season, since it's been a little while since we've talked about it. So as we enter the Memorial Day weekend, the end of May, let's see who's doing what in the old standings.
Cool. Do you want me to follow tradition and read them off for you?
You do it.
All right. So let's give the senior circuit their due and start them off. Let's start off with the NL this time. So we have a surprising leader, the Pittsburgh Pirates, you know, who I think we both agree, like they have some solid players, but, you know, maybe not by and large, one of the more talented teams.
They have speed and pitching. So they're like they're sort of a dead ball team surviving here in the new era.
So they're, and they had that big signing, right? They had, Rabbit Marinville? Was he the big signing that they had in the offseason?
Yep. And he's doing a very good job to start the year. One of the best shortstops in the league.
All right, so they're actually starting off really hot. They're 26-8 May 27th, Friday, May 27th, 1921, which is an outrageous 765 win-loss percentage. They're three up on the Giants, who are having a great start as well. They're 24-12, the New York Giants, three out. And then the Cubs are 15-15. as are the Brooklyn Robins at 19-19. So those two teams are tied at 9 out. So they're already 9 games out, both of those teams. Of course, the Robins are the defending National League champions. The Boston Braves are 16-17. The St. Louis Cardinals are 11-19. The Phillies are not in the cellar. They're 12-20. And I noticed that they're often referred to as the Quakers. I hadn't heard that before. Or maybe I heard that and forgot that. So that was kind of cool to me.
That was the official name earlier.
Okay.
And then it was just sort of still was used kind of for funsies, you know, how the reporters were. But yeah, that was definitely the official name for, like, we're talking like in the 1800s, like okay. Really, really early years. So yeah, that's a cool name.
And then the Reds, a little over a season removed from that World Series champion team, are 12-25 in the cellar, 15.5 out. All right. So moving over to the American League, we have the Tris Speaker-led Cleveland Indians at 25-13. So they're 3 up on the Yankees. Of course, the multi-talented Yankees who seem to have so many all-stars and, they have Ruth, of course, 20-14, 3 out. And then surprising third place team. That is Ty Cobb managed Detroit Tigers.
Nice.
He's got them playing really well. If we remember from last year, I think the Tigers started off like something like 0-13, something like that.
They won like 2 games in April and May combined.
And so they're actually off to a much better start at 21-20, 5.5 out. We have the Senators at 18-19, 6.5 out. The Red Sox at 13-16. The White Sox with their decimated lineup, 16-19. And our slobs, the St. Louis Browns, at 17-20. So all those teams are kind of in the middle there. They're all kind of tied up pretty much. And then, of course, the Philadelphia Athletics, who are just, you know, in the middle of a real, I guess, rebuilding would be I don't know if they did. They use their term rebuilding at the time in the 1920s. We'll have to look that up. Yeah.
It was definitely known as a concept, but it was frowned upon. Connie Mack didn't care. He was
kind of like, was like the progenitor of that, I think, in some ways. He would have these incredible teams for years, and then he would sell them off. And then he would have a period of, if you look at like, the Athletics history, you can see that trend up and down, up and down. So,
sure.
So they're 12-21, 10.5 out. So yeah, so there's your standings.
And I was looking at some of the individual performances, just checking out some of the articles. I happened to see an article in the middle of May about Rogers Hornsby, who was really having an amazing start to the season. As of the middle of May, he was hitting .471. So, I mean, that was, you know, not too many games into the year yet. But then I looked, just picked some random numbers. At 25 games into the year, he was hitting .457. And then, and then at 50 games into the year, he was still hitting .420. So as of today's date, I looked, May 27th, he was hitting .457. Which was almost 100 points higher than Marinville, who was the number two in terms of average for the year. So then I was just digging into Hornsby a little bit, because these are just like, these are fun numbers to look at. I found something kind of surprising. I didn't know. It was curiosity. He hit over 400. Put it this way. His average was over 400 for every single game of the year, except for the first and the last. How weird is that?
That's so weird.
On the opening day, he went 1-for-3 and with a walk, so he was hitting .333. And then on the second game, he went 3-for-4, so he was, hitting .570 or something, 4-for-7. And then he stayed over 400 for the whole entire year until the very last game of the year, when he went 0-for-4, and his average ended up at, like, .398, I think, or something like
that. Why didn't he set out that last game? Yeah.
I know. They weren't in the pennant chase. So .397, he ended up at .397. So his average went from an even 4, dropped 3 points because he went over 4 the last day of the year. Which, like, that math doesn't seem exactly right, but that's what it said on BB Reference. So he would have had a year at 400 if he would have just bounced one day early, but he played every game that year.
Wasn't his style.
He led the league in a lot of categories, including games played. He was tied for first. He played every game of the year. Led the league in runs, hits, 44 doubles, 18 triples, 126 RBIs. His on base was .458. His slugging percentage was .639. I mean,
that's unbelievable.
That's a really great year. He led the league in total bases too. Even though he didn't have a ton of homers, because he had, I was only total was, it wasn't bad for the time, but it wasn't like Ruth numbers, but those doubles and triples. I happened to see the following year, he had over 150 RBIs, which is one of the great like RBI seasons of all time. So where'd he go?
Quite a hitter.
Yeah. Where'd go, Roger? Quite a bummer that he ended up not getting the 400. I mean, I know it's just a round number that doesn't super mean anything, but.
Yeah, I wonder how much that was like a thing back then, right? You know, that threshold, you know, if they thought about it the same way.
That's a good question. I don't really know. Like, were they were all very concerned about average, and like who was the batting champ was a very big deal. But like, did that number 400, because it wasn't so rare, like,
right, you know, yeah. If you look at like the all time, you know, 400 seasons, I think the large majority of them are before like 1930, right?
Yeah.
So yeah.
For sure. But then speaking of the batting average race, I happened to then look at the over in the American League, and that was really interesting. The best hitter that year in the AL was Harry Heilman from the Tigers. I can't remember if we talked about him at all.
Maybe a little bit.
That was familiar, but he wasn't that great in 1920. But then he went to have a huge... 21. I just looked at some of his numbers. He had 168 hits in 1920, 237 hits in 1921, and basically the same number of ABs. That led the league, 237. His batting average was 394. That led the league. His OBP was 444. He didn't walk a ton. But he led the league, or he, I guess he set a record for like a hitting streak to start the year. So he, it said that he, I guess he had something like 16, he had a hit in his first 16 games of the year.
Wow.
And then he, it said he, the guy who ended his streak was, I just wrote his name down because it was funny, Jez Zachariah. But no, I'm sorry, Zachary. But his first name's Jez, J-Z Zachary, the pitcher for the Senators. That's who ended the hitting streak. This article also mentioned something that I just thought was so dumb. It says, the Detroit Tigers were the first club to face pitching 1,000 times. They turned this trick May 16th. What does that mean?
I have no idea what that means. What does that mean?
It's just a sentence. There's no, it's its own paragraph.
Maybe that means that they played 1,000 games? No, that can't be right. They played way more than 1,000 games at this point.
Yeah, because 1,000 games would only be like 10 years. And they mean like 1,000 plate appearances for the year? No.
How many maybe that's what that is.
How many plate appearances are in a game? I mean, on average. Yeah, like 40, right? Like if it's 27 outs and whatever, 10 but guys.
If they played 50 games times 40 plate appearances, that's only what?
That's 2,000.
Oh, that's 2,000. So, yeah, I guess.
Oh, but this was in the middle of May, though.
Yeah,
this
so that May. Would be right. Okay, that sounds right.
What a stupid thing to track, though. Who cares? That's totally meaningless. And every other team was going to get there soon after. That doesn't mean anything. Anyway, I just thought that was weird.
The Tigers, though, yeah, we need to talk a little bit more about the Tigers. I think,
well, yeah, a little bit more about Harry Heilman. His nickname was Slug, which sounds like a cool nickname for a hitter, but it's actually just because he was slow. It's because he was like slow as a slug. It was not because he was a good hitter. But it is really interesting. He was pretty decent in 1920. Had a great 1921. And then some people were like, well, it's that new baseball. They had these discussions 100 years ago. They're like, it's the lively baseball. And then there was like some reporters going kind of back and forth. The other one was like, he's hitting the same ball as everybody else. Like, why is it benefiting him so much and not everyone else? We're like, well, that's a fair point. But then the other were saying, like, it's possible like his style of hitting in particular benefited because he was really a line drive hitter. And so just – the outfielder started to play deeper because of the home runs, and then his line drives just and they
more
carried
fell in.
Enough,
to
leave the infield, but not lofted enough to be out. So his style of hitting was really it's a theory, but
yeah, I mean, he is a monster. If you look at his career stats, he would averaged 41 doubles a season and hit 342 lifetime, which is those are really impressive stats right there. So
the theory as to why he had a good 1921, take a guess.
His other theory, Ty Cobb?
Exactly. Some of the a reporter said, well, he is benefiting from his manager now, is the great Ty Cobb. So I found a little article about Cobb as a manager. If you remember last time, there was that story, that guy, that pitcher, I think his name was Suds, who gave up a home run, and then Cobb took him out of the game and cut him from the team, and he never played in the majors again. It was like 5-0.
Yeah.
He got Cobb. Yeah. Suds got straight up Cobb. But this little article mentioned that he was a good manager. It says, okay, Cobb was a, I'm just going to read this piece. It's funny. Cobb was a temperamental star, reporting for spring training when it suited his convenience, which I think is funny because you still hear that. Like guys who were late to camp, it's still like a diva move, but this was the same thing 100 years ago. Cobb was known for playing his own game regardless of managerial instructions. Beyond a doubt, his system was effective, but for many years, it did not tend to improve the discipline, morale, or teamwork of the Tigers. It's different now. Cobb is still playing his brilliant individual game, but he has subordinated it to the best interests of the team. Always a thorough workman, he is manifesting an exclusive ability that is reflected in the briskness of the Tiger play. He bears his responsibilities well, and like Tris Speaker, is in the thick of the fray at all times, coaching his men and making quick decisions in strategical emergencies. So they compare him to Cobb. I mean, they compare him to Speaker, who was probably the most renowned player manager at the time. So Cobb was like getting some props for doing a good job as
a manager. I thought they contrasted him with Speaker in the previous article that we were looking at.
Yes, they definitely did, because I think that they imagined Cobb was going to be like a hothead and all the things he was as a player, and then now month into the season or so, he's
2 months. Cobb was more like Cobb was more like a micromanager, and Speaker was more of this kind of what do they call it nowadays, Josh, when they like look at the statistics and they just go by that? What is that called?
Like a by the book manager or
sabermetrics? Sabermetrics. He was like an early sabermetrics manager.
That's true. He did do a lot of shifting.
With like shifting and tunes and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just take that as a compliment that they even mentioned Speaker in Cobb's managerial write up here. They thought he was doing a good job. This is kind of crazy. Getting back to Hauman and Cobb then. So I do know that the batting champ was a big deal. Remember that? I don't know if that was still going on this year.
Yeah, we talked about like the Chalmers Award, right? Or was it
you could win a car. It was a big deal. And so Cobb and Hauman were like neck and neck right to the very end of the year. And of course, stat keeping was like, pencil and paper, right? Like it wasn't computerized like it is now.
I can sense something coming here.
So the year ends. It actually ended probably as good as possible for Hauman, because it showed Cobb ahead. And so Cobb ended the year and they declared him the batting champ. And then someone went back and reran the numbers and Hauman got it. So I'm thinking if Hauman was in first, Cobb would have made sure he wasn't. He would have probably benched him or hit him, batted the change him, lowered him in order.
Because there was an error. So Cobb let Hauman loose, and otherwise he would have probably finagled it.
Yeah. So Cobb ended up in second, and they had number one and number two. You got to imagine what that dugout was like when you're the young Hauman and you're challenging your boss, the famously temperamental, to say the least, Ty Cobb, who's your boss and your fellow outfielder, and you're neck and neck for the record, both, hitting almost 400.
That's bizarre. We'll have to find an article or two towards later this season and just look into that, because that's such a bizarre dynamic. The manager is competing with one of his players for the batting crown.
Right.
And
right,
like down to all that, like, day. You know, like, do I want to win? Do we want to win the batting? Like, what's more important, you know?
Yeah, especially when your team's out of it. I mean, they weren't as bad as they were the year before, but they were not challenging for the pennant. So, it was pretty interesting. As of this date, at the end of May, his average was up to .465, Hauman's was. So these guys had some hot starts here, Hauman and Hornsby, as the league leaders. Hauman, one other note about that is that he did end up breaking 400 in a couple years later, 23. So he died kind of young. He was the Tigers announcer for a long time, became famous for that. Died in his 50s of lung cancer and was elected to the Hall of Fame the following year. So he wasn't elected in his lifetime, which he died in 51 and then in 52 was elected. So I wonder why he wasn't
Surprised me a little bit. He had pretty good numbers.
I wonder why it took his death to get him into the hall. You know, I would think he would have been elected as soon as he was eligible.
I think also, Josh, and this again, this could be incorrect, but from what I kind of remember or gather, the hall was like incredibly exclusive for the first 20, 30 years. Incredibly exclusive, and they only had so many spots per year or something, and they had quite a backlog, so to speak, right? So, I mean, I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think that's what I've gathered.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So probably just didn't make the cut right away because they had guys like Ruth, Walter Johnson, Christy Mathewson, those kind of guys.
Yeah, you had to be like one of the like the best player of that. Of your era to get in. Well, let's talk a little bit more about this interesting case with Eddie Grant. And I don't know too much about how people were drafted for the war, or who got in and who didn't, or who got sent overseas and who didn't. But there was, I think it said there were 8 players who died in the war, either killed in battle or died of illness. And so what was kind of interesting then was this story about the monument in the Polo Grounds. Did you come across that?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about how there was a monument put up, right? Decoration Day or on Memorial Day, which would have been, I guess, the 30th of... We also talked about how it was always May 30th at that time. It wasn't that like last Monday in May. It was May 30th, whatever day that fell on. Which I thought was interesting.
When you're closer to it, like that date itself means something.
But yeah,
Do you know why it's chosen as that date? I don't.
I'm sure there's a good reason. I know that like Memorial Day stems from Civil War remembrance.
Oh, really?
And it was kind of organically adopted over the years to the point where it became like a national holiday. But I don't know if it was even officially a national holiday at this time. And I also don't know why May 30th was chosen. It may have some sort of significance, or it may just have been like a tradition of that weekend or that time period, right?
It looks like there's a lot of myths regarding the creation of it, but that is true that it went back to the Civil War. Oh, and it was the date that people would decorate the graves.
The memorials, because there was that period of American history, which is very interesting, where a lot of these local groups would put together money and then they would erect a monument to a soldier from the Civil War. I mean, we've been obviously been talking, it's been a lot in the news recently as well. And that era is not too far removed from 1921, but yeah, I imagine that was a day when they would probably decorate those memorials, like you're saying. So yeah.
And it goes all the way back to the Civil War.
So anyway, so you mentioned Eddie Grant Memorial, which was put up 100 years ago on Decoration Day. Maybe we should just call it Memorial Day. I don't know. I'm confusing myself here. But
I like it. I like anachronistic names. I enjoy it.
And you had run across the funny little article about that, right?
Well, yeah.
Sort of mystery surrounding that.
Yeah, so, I mean, first of all, a little more about Grant. He was really well-loved. He was just known as a, average player, but a really just stand-up dude. And everyone was really, fond of him. And so he was actually old enough that he wouldn't have been drafted, but he volunteered to fight in the war. So he was 34 at the time, and he signed up to enlist and became a captain, landed in France, died tragically in the Argonne. And then here's a quote from John McGraw. He was not the flashy player, Grant, but he was one of the gamest I ever knew. Like, it called him like a gamer, right? He always gave me the best, and criticism only made him steadier. He never gave his managers any troubles, and he was a chap of fine habits. So, he was just a really well-liked dude. And this memorial was a big deal. It was, I think that the text, that opening, the poem was actually the text that was on the memorial. So the words by Grantland Rice were written on the actual monument. And so anyway, cut ahead to 1957 when the Polo Grounds closed. And like, everyone's just at the last game or running around the field doing that kind of stuff that you do. And someone pried the monument off and took it, and it disappeared. And it was not, it was just missing for decades. And then at some point, like in the 90s, someone claimed to have found it in the home of this deceased New York City police officer who lived in Hoboken, New Jersey, that they claimed that it was found. But then this was like, when images of this began to circulate, there was a lot of folks who said that it was not real. Let me just read you this. It says, apparently this guy who died was one of the cops who rescued the plaque from some hoodlums who were trying to steal it after the last Giants game in 57. And then this group bought it. And then someone then accused them of being a fake. But then they said, why would it? So they said it's a 75-pound bronze plaque. And so then the response was like, you know, of the historian who ended up with it was like, who would forge a 70, like who would randomly forge a 75-pound bronze plaque that was like missing for 40 years? So, you know, it now ends up, it ends up in this archive in California, which is, I believe it's where he was from. And, anyway, but there's still some debate as to whether or not it was the original one. It seems likely. I mean, this police officer rescued it from the hoodlums. That makes him sound like the star of the story, but why did it end up in his house?
Maybe he didn't want it to go to California. Maybe he wanted it to stay in New York area. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then there is a replica of it in the Giants' current stadium, which is also in California, whose name I forget. But
they keep changing it. It might be like AT&T or
So that was interesting. It was, you know, Grant was seemed like a really noble person, and a really you know, the whole country was obviously grieving a lot and trying to move ahead from this, you know, national tragedy of a great number of war losses. And Grant kind of became the MLB's like poster child for war sacrifice. So yeah, interesting stuff. 100 years ago, Memorial Day was really, I'm sure a lot of tears were shed when they dedicated that monument and read that poem. To change gears like completely. Yeah. I just found some really fun stuff I wanted to share. This is just such a pointless, but like very enjoyable Babe Ruth article. I'm just going to read it to you. This is from actually earlier in the month, May 4th, 1921. Baseball fans the country over have known for 2 years that Babe Ruth had transferred his batting headquarters from Boston to New York, but City Hall made it official only today. Served in his bathtub with a warrant for unpaid taxes of $27.21 on his automobile for 2 years, the outfielder noted that he had not been a resident of the city since the fall of 1919. His objection unavailing, he dressed in haste, took the constable in his automobile, and whirled to City Hall, where the city tax collector arranged for him to certify that the assessment was an error. Nice of them to keep me on as a citizen of Boston, but rather rough to ask me to pay for their privilege, Ruth remarked as he left City Hall.
Love it. Ruth, in his bathtub. The man must have loved his bathtubs, because I feel like I've heard about him in a bathtub many times over. Maybe that was just like a thing at the time. I mean, you know, Taft, Ruth, people just like to hang out in bathtubs.
I feel like Teddy Roosevelt, too. You hear some Roosevelt in the tub stories. It seems like a thing. But also, it definitely seems like Babe Ruth.
Yeah, I feel like he probably, like, fell asleep in his bathtub. He probably spent more time than any person in America at the time in a bathtub.
He probably drank in there.
Oh, yeah, cigars, drinking.
For sure. But why did they bother to serve him with a warrant for $27 in his tub? And then he's like nude in the tub, gets dressed, drives the constable in his car to City Hall to like debate it. This is so weird. Everything with that story is so weird.
What a maniac.
I do enjoy it. And yeah. And then he just gives like a funny quote on the way out. I don't know. That's a good slice of life. That's a good story. You shared another article about I guess it was the article of the Phillies / Quakers Giants game. They played a doubleheader on Memorial Day.
So yeah, so the same day they unveiled the memorial, they played a doubleheader, which we probably assumed that was like a, you know, a tradition at the time to play doubleheaders on holidays. I mean, it even was, I think, when I was a kid. I think that would happen sometimes, if I remember correctly. Right. Yeah. And they're playing in the Polo Grounds, of course, against the Phillies, the Giants against the Phillies. The Giants sweep both games. The article is great. It's just
incredible.
Incredible article. It compares the visit. It says the visitors developed rabies in the afternoon after you know,
that caught my eye too. Yeah. That's an insane sentence. Their point is the Phillies played really lackluster in the first game, and then got fired up in game two and made it closer. But the way to say that was like they developed rabies.
Yes, this is from the New York Times from May 31st, 1921. You can find it on our website if you have a library card, or you can if you can find it somewhere else. It's just a great article, but it mentions it calls Philadelphia the Quaker City. It talks about a greasy Neal catch where he makes the catch, but he basically knocks himself out. He cuts his cheek.
That's like the Aaron Rowland catch.
And gets taken out of the game. He doesn't play. I don't know how long he's going to be out.
I'm surprised he didn't just like slide off the wall with all the grease on his face.
Yeah. I mean, the second game was 13-7. So you can imagine how sloppy of a game that must have been.
Well, everyone had rabies.
Yeah. You know, hoisted the pellet into the upper stand.
So I went through.
Yeah, that was the one that that was your quote. So I don't know if you want to read that one. Yeah.
I went through and I found all the synonyms for ways the guy said it hit. This is just in one article. And I made a list here for you, because this is just 1920s sports writing, just glory. Okay. Wrapped the ball, cracked the ball, belted a homer. His slap bounded erratically, hoisted the pellet. Wanged a double. So that's wanged, spelled W-H-A-N-G-E-D. Wanged a double, walloped the globule, lambasted the sphere, cracked a single, waved the wand, and hoisted the sphere. I mean, so they just full-on went with the thesaurus. Every time they had to find a different word for the ball, they couldn't just say ball. Sphere, globule.
Globule is great. Yeah, and, so and you said that they referred to an inning as a canto. Is that a musical term? What is that?
I think so. A canto is like a movement in a musical piece.
I love it.
I don't know.
Beautiful.
It's something to do with music. It caught my eye. And here's how they describe a foul ball. So Quigley is the umpire. That's a good name for an ump. So the batter was Curtis Walker. Walker hoisted the pellet into the upper stand in the seventh and trotted over the highways. But Quigley got out his sextant and his microscope and decided that the thrust had been foul. So it's like a nautical equipment.
And yeah, what's a sextant again?
I think it's a thing that you use on a ship to like orient yourself with the stars.
It kind of
looks like a telescope a little bit, but like with this.
It measures the angular distance between two visible objects.
Yeah, they would use, like, I think it was used on a ship. So they just sort of paint the picture of the ump here with his, telescope. Measuring the angles and determined that the thrust had been foul.
Now, I am disappointed there's no mention of any Bengals, you know, no Bengals and Bungles.
I did find Bengals in another article though of this week. Thank God. It wasn't just that one article. It wasn't just that one author. It was a number of dudes who went with Bengals. So I hope everyone out there has a good Memorial Day. I hope that you have a quality, just remind everyone that it used to be called Decoration Day. You'll be the life of your party. Just tell everyone, no, it used to be called Decoration Day. And then, try to work wallop the globule into your recaps of modern game. So that, I think, is what Eddie Grant would want.
Yeah, that is our, what's the word?
That's our takeaway.
Our takeaway, but also our challenge to you sports writers out there. All right.
Yes.
It's time to start.
No one ever uses the word wanked.
They'd probably get in trouble for using that word.
Or at least just call the ball a globule. I mean, come on, just once. I mean, how many times is Tatis hoisting the pellet? I mean, it just sounds good. you gotta bring it up there. So, all right, Sweet Bread, thanks for catching Sounds us good. Up on the exciting week of baseball, and enjoy your holiday. And
thanks, Bucketfoot, you as well, everybody else out there.
And I will talk to you all soon, next time on This Week in 1920 Baseball.
Later.
No one ever uses the word wangs.